Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll look at Iowa through the lens of photographer Barry Phipps. His new book is Between Gravity and What Cheer. But first, there's a new picture book that's bound to become a classic graduation gift. It's called Sometimes You Fly, and it celebrates some of the many milestones that children hit before they walk across that stage and receive a diploma. It's written by Newbery Award-winning author Catherine Applegate and illustrated by Iowa City-based artist Jennifer Black Reinhart. I will be talking with Jennifer Black Reinhart in just a few minutes, but I'm going to start with Catherine Applegate. She's best known for her Newbery Award-winning book, The One and Only Ivan. She's also written some other truly beautiful and remarkable novels for middle grade readers, including Crenshaw and most recently The Wish Tree. And she is with me now on the line. Hello, Catherine.
Well, hello. It's so lovely to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. And I would love to talk a little bit about your background as a writer. I first discovered your books reading your series, Roscoe Riley Rules, which is a series about a little boy who gets into trouble quite a lot, although he always means well. And they're very funny transitional books for beginning readers. And I started looking into your other work, and going back through time, I find your name on a lot of different kinds of work. So tell me how you became a writer.
Oh, it's like asking about sausage and legislation. You don't really want to know how it was done. I have to apologize in advance. Excuse me, I'm getting over bronchitis. I was on a school tour, and it's sort of an occupational hazard.
Sure.
I began writing. I had a degree in English from the University of Texas and was terrified to become a writer. It seemed like such an incredibly public way to fail. And it is, it turns out. So I dipped my toe into the water by becoming a ghostwriter, and I worked for Disney, and I worked for numerous packagers. I wrote 17 Sweet Valley Twins. Women of a certain age will remember that as well. And gradually learned a great deal that way. It's actually a wonderful way to learn about pacing and deadlines and all those complicated things. And very gradually got up the nerve to start writing my own work. And in fact, my first big success was with my husband, Michael Grant, a series called Animorphs, which we basically submitted over the transom to Gene Fywell at Scholastic. I wanted to write about animals. He wanted to write about aliens. And it ended up selling like 35 million copies worldwide.
When a lot of people first heard your name, it was when The One and Only Ivan was published and then, of course, won the Newbery Award. And the novel, for people who don't know, it's about unexpected friendships, but the main character is a gorilla, a captive gorilla who's part of a zoo in a shopping mall, and his name is Ivan. And this book is so different from anything that you had written before. Do you feel like this is the moment when you really, truly found your voice as a writer?
That's an interesting question. I think because your voice changes over time. I had done a free verse novel called Home of the Brave, which was about a Sudanese refugee in Minneapolis. I had been living in Minnesota at the time and was just marveling at the capacity of people to readjust their lives and learn about a new culture, and not to mention dealing with, 12-foot snowdrifts. And so I had experimented a little bit with smaller pieces of prose on the page, and I enjoyed doing it, partly because I think I'm a frustrated poet, but also probably because I'm a little bit lazy, and I love moving from one page to the next. I was also a reluctant reader, and I always tell kids this, excuse me, when I do tours, because typically most authors were, flashlight under the covers kind of readers. And as it happened, I just wasn't really engaged with reading. Charlotte's Web was for me that you know, that book, that moment where I started to say, wow, there's a reason people read books. But it took me quite a while to get there. And I think as a reluctant reader, writing Ivan in very, very spare prose with lots of white space on the page appealed to me both because it reflected his experience, but also because it allowed me to play with words in a different way.
Having the success that you had with the one and only Ivan, how did that change how you wrote from that point on, or how you're writing today?
Well, it scared me. And I don't think that's unusual. Excuse me. Post Newbery, it's really wonderful if you already have a book in the works. And as it happened, I didn't. And it's just such overwhelming and remarkable attention and such a glorious way to know that your book will not end up on the remainder's table, you know. It's like getting hit by lightning. It's such a remarkable thing to have happen. So I think it was a little intimidating for a while, but then I missed writing. And at the end of the day, I always tell people you're going to be a writer if you walk away from it and you can't and you have to go back. And I absolutely had to go back. It's now being made into a movie by Disney, and that has been sort of a fascinating experience. They'll be doing CGI, so obviously the animals will be computer generated. But Angelina Jolie is doing one of the voices, and Bryan Cranston, and to watch that unfold from this little idea that I thought at the time, I remember thinking no one will ever read this book, is really unbelievable.
Your subsequent novels, Crenshaw and The Wish Tree, we'll start with Crenshaw, but it's a book where I knew that I wanted to read it with my kids, but I didn't know that I could sell it to them. So mm-hmm. I said it's about a boy and his imaginary friend who's a giant cat. And they were like, yes, we'll read that with you. I didn't tell them that it's about food insecurity and homelessness, which is also a really important part of the book. And you were able to tell that story in such a beautiful way that the sadness that you have to deal with in a story like that doesn't overwhelm the story and doesn't overwhelm the readers. In approaching, and really the one and only Ivan, there was so much sadness as well. I'm curious about how you balance the message that you're trying to share, which can be a little overwhelming, with the magic of reading and telling a story.
You know, I think, and I have two children, but they're well into their teens now. I think going back to schools frequently has really helped me remember the audience for whom I'm writing, because these kids are, I love writing for middle graders. They're idealistic, and they've started thinking about fairness and the great big wide world, but they're innocent and engaged in a way that is so very special. It's a really special time. And by talking to them, I'm reminded how much they can handle and how much they really do know. Our parental instincts are always to cherish them as little ones as long as we can and to protect them. But they see the world. They know kids are hungry. They know there are big problems in the world. And I love trying to find a way to leaven that information with enough humor and hopefully plot to make it palatable. But I don't think of it as medicine at all. It's just I write about things that I care about. Perhaps because I wrote for so long as a ghostwriter, I truly value being able to sit down and write about something that just really moves me or angers me. I wrote Wish Tree during the election because I was just frustrated and I needed, you know, catharsis. So it's for me as much as them, I suppose.
Well, and before we talk about Wish Tree, there was something that I noticed when I was reading Crenshaw. And there are not a lot of illustrations in the book, but the way the book is illustrated, it's impossible to know the ethnic identity of the family that's profiled. Jackson, the little boy whose family is insecure, mm-hmm. he could be any little boy. Was that important to you to make sure that any child could see themselves in him?
Oh, I think that's so important, especially with that topic. You know, it was really interesting when I did school visits. I would go to very affluent schools, and the kids would be doing food drives. And I would go to Title I schools, and the kids would be that little boy in the book. They would be Jackson. And it was an interesting balancing act talking to them, because they were two extremes on that same bar, but at the end of the day they were united by the fact that they were just little kids. And I think it's very important in a context like that to make it clear that it happens to everyone, and it's not a racial issue or a cultural issue. It's inexcusable in a country as affluent as ours.
We read a lot about representation in children's books and lack of representation in children's books. In The Wish Tree, you have a more diverse cast of characters beyond the tree, and all of the animals that live in the tree, they're very important characters as well. But has that become an important part of your mission?
Well, I think it's become an imperative in children's literature, and we need diverse books, and other organizations have been on the forefront of that. I think it's so important that a child be able to see him or herself in a book, and for years and years that just wasn't the case. And now when you go to the shelves, you're starting to see glimmers of all kinds of authors and all kinds of stories that haven't been told up till now. And that is wonderful for everyone.
I'm talking with Newbery Award-winning author Catherine Applegate. She has a new picture book out, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment as well. But we are going to take a short break. We will be back. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me right now is Catherine Applegate. She is a Newbery Award-winning author, most famous for her book, The One and Only Ivan. She has just released a new children's book that is bound to be a classic graduation gift this year and for many years to come. It's called Sometimes You Fly, and the illustrator of that book is an Iowa City-based artist, Jennifer Black Reinhardt. She's going to join us in just a couple of minutes. Before we dive into Sometimes You Fly, Catherine, I do want to talk just a little bit more about The Wish Tree, which is another book that, trying to summarize it, may be difficult to sell it to whoever wants to pick it up, but it's well worth picking up. The story is told from the perspective of a very old oak tree that has a reputation as being a wish tree in his neighborhood. But also, there are these two children that are in the story. Samara, who is a newcomer to this neighborhood, she's Muslim, her family is Muslim, and she encounters hate in the neighborhood, and also her friendship that develops with her neighbor, Stephen. You said you started writing this during the election. What inspired you?
Oh, the endless vitriol on every side. And the othering of groups. We were seeing so much of that. And I remember a story about a note that had been left on the door of a Muslim family that basically said, "Go away."
And that happened here in Iowa City.
I thought it was in Iowa.
It did.
That's right.
I know that family.
Oh, and that, you know, and it just so enraged me, and it was actually that incident that was the catalyst for writing the book. And in fact, as I was touring a few weeks ago, I happened to be at a school where a Muslim mother had been in the parking lot, a very diverse school, and had been verbally attacked. And she ran into the school for safety. And one of the moms who happened to be there had been reading Wish Tree to her son at that time and remarked on the fact that it was, you know, art imitating life, imitating art. And the whole school ended up reading Wish Tree and using it sort of as a springboard to talk about how they could work as a community and heal. It's so heartbreaking to see that kind of thing.
Well, the fact that you went from that to thinking about a book told by a giant oak tree gives us a little bit of glimpse into how creative you are, how your mind works. But I do want to talk about this new picture book, Sometimes You Fly. And it's a celebration. It's a short poem. There aren't a lot of words in the book, but it's a celebration of the milestones that children hit along the way as they grow and blossom and culminates in graduation, which of course is only the beginning of everyone's story. But tell me where this poem came from.
Oh, I think of it very much as a celebration of screwing up. It's I am a master of mistake making. I suppose we all are, but I was one of those kids who really didn't think I was supposed to get anything wrong. And I wanted to remind kids that, yes, of course you're going to fail. You're going to fail magnificently and repeatedly, and that's how we learn. And we spend so much time celebrating the big milestones, the birthdays and graduations, that we sometimes forget about all those little tiny steps that went into the process. And that's where I think Jennifer did such a fantastic job showing those moments. I mean, she did the heavy lifting on this book. I handed her a few words, and her illustrations they're so charming, and they leap off the page, and they tell very complicated stories.
You mentioned the picture, so I want to bring Jennifer into the conversation because it is not a very long poem, but the illustrations just really spark your imagination and tell so many stories. Jennifer Black Reinhardt, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having us. And hi, Catherine.
Hi, this is actually the first time we've spoken.
It is.
Well, I'm glad I could bring you together. Jennifer, how did you get involved in this project?
Well, it's interesting. You know, people always want to know how that happened. And the author and the illustrator never work together or rarely work together when doing a book. By the time I get offered the manuscript to illustrate, they pretty much want to see what I'm going to bring to the project. And so it's kind of free reign, especially at first, because they don't want to squelch my ideas. And then it's after that, it just turns into a big collaboration. I love how many people it takes to make a book. It's a lot. So.
Well, and again, with so few words, Catherine, were you nervous about getting paired with an illustrator? Because this story was going to depend very heavily on the illustrator.
Oh, not as soon as Jennifer Green, our editor, showed me her work, I knew she'd be perfect because everything, I mean, these are tiny domestic scenes, most of them, so dependent on, you know, the expressions of the children or the frustrations of the parents. And I saw one and I thought, oh, wow, this is just going to be magnificent. I actually cried when I got the final sketches because it was just, it's such an interesting moment to collaborate with someone without really, you know, having them in the room with you. And to have them understand what you were trying to do is it's really exciting.
Well, and Jennifer was saying that she had kind of free reign at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Were you able to share any of your vision or your ideas about what those pictures should look like?
I think that was very much up to Jennifer. I mean, there are so many ways there are so many ways things could be taken. There's a line before the seas where we see a little boy who's afraid to get in the water. And she could have taken that any number of directions, but she ended up with this glorious picture of a little boy who's finally learned to swim in front of the ocean. And it could not have been more perfect. So, no, I don't really have the visual mind for that. That's very much an illustrator's gift.
Well, Jennifer, tell me about when you got the poem, then how did you start? What was your process?
One of the things, I think, Catherine, I think Jennifer had said she asked you to give examples of what you were seeing in some of them, and I did read those. One of the challenges for me was I wanted it to be in an individual accomplishment. So the one that stands out to me is the baby crying before the laugh. And I think it'd be obvious that a baby would be crying. And then I think the obvious next page would be being comforted by your parents. It'd be a beautiful picture of mom and dad hugging the child, and now he's laughing. But that isn't showing what I think the real message and deeper meaning of the book should be, which is that these are all individual accomplishments that we do. We need help along the way, and we learn and we count on people, but it's basically up to us to power through these things. And so I had the little baby comforting himself with his teddy bear. And so I was trying to think of things like that that kind of took away a layer and dug to maybe a deeper meaning in a page turn.
Yeah. So. How long did you spend working on these pictures and coming up with that vision?
Law, you know, I always get asked that. And so I went back and I'd love to hear how long Catherine worked on it too. I signed up to be on board in July 2015, I think it was. I did not work on it right away. I had another project. And then, it's a real back and forth where I do parts and then I wait a month to hear revisions. And so it's all that kind of back and forth. But so I a solid 2 years of back and forths for me.
What's your medium? How do you create these images? And what's the progression? Like, what do you start with?
I would submit pencil sketches to them digitally, and then go from revisions on that. Hopefully there aren't too many. And then I work on watercolor paper, and I paint first, and then I go in with ink line second. And often a little bit of collage in my work, not too much. And I'm pretty old school. I like to have a finished product at the end that feels like I, bled on it a little. So I still work that way.
So the images that we see in the book, what are the original images like? Do you work in a much larger format, or do you work in the size that's going to be represented on the page?
I usually do it to size. And so hopefully they look pretty much like they do. There were some changes that we did do digitally so that I didn't have to, repaint the whole thing or something. But no, there aren't too many.
How did you start this line of work? How did you become an illustrator?
I grew up in a family. My mother is an artist, and my grandmother was an artist. And just quirky, they collected picture books. I mean, my grandmother have an amazing library of amazing antique picture books. And my mom and I just kind of studied them when I was little, and it occurred to me that I could draw those pictures, that I love to draw. And so really, I never thought about doing anything else. It's what I always wanted to do.
And how did you break in to illustration?
Yeah, that children's publishing per se was the challenging part. I did illustrate. I went to college and got my degree in illustration, and then worked as a freelance illustrator doing pretty much everything but greeting cards and humor books and calendars. And I liked all that, but at the same time I was just sending out postcards and trying to break in, going to SCBWI conferences, which is Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. That's a great network for people who are interested in learning more and getting involved. And then it just all happened maybe 15 or so years ago, all at once.
Do you have influences in children's literature that you look to, that you've admired?
There's so many. I spend a lot of time really kind of studying the craft of picture book making. I really don't have one. Literary wise, it was always more whimsical. We talked about Charlotte's Web a little bit ago. I like a sense of whimsy and maybe nostalgia a little bit.
Catherine, where did the inspiration for the poem that became Sometimes You Fly come from?
Well, the first line was before the cake. And I am a notoriously bad chef. I'm not even allowed in the kitchen. Fortunately, my husband likes to cook, as do my daughters. And I suspect there may have been an attempt at some kind of recipe that did not entirely fly. And the illustration is wonderful. When I toured with this, and I had the illustrations up on a big screen, so I'd be talking to, like, you know, several hundred kids, and I would show them this first picture, and I'd say, Jennifer, you would have loved this. It was so fun. I'd say, look at that mom. And it's a picture of a mom, and she's surrounded by, you know, there's flour in the baby's head, and there's smoke coming out of the oven. She's clearly attempting to make a cake and clearly failing miserably. And I say, does that mom look happy to you? And the kids just laugh hysterically, and they're almost, I think, relieved to see that, oh, adults make mistakes too, which was a wonderful little embellishment in the book. I think it's important for us to understand that you don't stop making mistakes when you graduate from high school. It goes on forever. So I think it was just this attempt to let kids know that it's okay to fail.
Well, the book, as I mentioned, the words are sparse, the illustrations are beautiful, and it really packs an emotional punch. My children would tell you that I'm pretty easy to punch emotionally, that I'll cry at anything, but still, you know, I was just flipping through the book quickly when I got my hands on it, and I got to the Sometimes You Fly moment and, of course, burst into tears. I mean, there's so much beauty there. And it's such a, hopefully it's a universal experience. I mean, we all make mistakes. We all fail. But there are those moments when we can see our potential, when mm-hmm. we have those successes. I mean, Catherine, in writing the book, you must have been thinking about your kids, too.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and the kids I talk to at schools are often, I get kids who say, how can I publish tomorrow? And I always tell them the story that when I wrote The One and Only Ivan, I have this little piece of paper I keep with me that says, the question is, do I give up on Ivan or not? Because I was halfway through the book and ready to toss it in the trash. And I remind them, you know, tenacity is important, perseverance matters, and you're not always going to succeed. But if we can teach our kids that, oh, that's a very important lesson.
Jennifer, have you gotten the opportunity to read this book with kids?
I had the launch party at Prairie Lights, and so it wasn't all kids, but no, I would love to. I have some things coming up where I should get to do that, and I'm excited. Catherine had mentioned that was so fun to...
Oh, it's great fun.
Do you have a favorite page, a favorite work that made it into the book?
I do. Mine is actually the one that's sad, which is the little funeral scene. When breezes blow, we learn to bend. I thought that was a really important kind of message to get in there, because it's not all happy, and it is overcoming things, and it is helping each other overcome things, and that sometimes things don't go right, and maybe they stay that way, and it's learning to bend and go with it, and so that's a meaningful piece for me.
Oh, that's a it's a beautiful picture, too. It's just gorgeous.
You. Do you have a favorite, Catherine?
I do. It's a little more whimsical. It's where child and dog have clearly broken something, and They are sitting there with multiple "I'm sorry" signs, and a looming shadow is approaching, and it's very charming and very funny.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being here today. Catherine Applegate, thank you so much for talking with me and for your really remarkable work.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been great fun.
And Jennifer Black Reinhardt, thank you.
Thank you. This was great.
Jennifer Black Reinhardt is an Iowa City-based artist. You can see her work most recently in the new picture book by Catherine Applegate. It's called Sometimes You Fly, and it celebrates some of the many milestones that children hit before they walk across the stage and receive a diploma. And it'll make you cry, too. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about another new work, Between Gravity and What Cheer. We'll take a look at the state of Iowa through the lens of photography. Barry Phipps. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Multimedia artist Barry Phipps has been traveling the state of Iowa and taking pictures for the last 6 years. Now we can see Iowa through his lens in the new book, Between Gravity and What Cheer. He'll be at Film Scene in Iowa City at 5:30 on Thursday, May 3rd, a book signing followed by a lecture, an opportunity to share what he learned taking these pictures. And he is here with me now. Hello, Barry.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thrilled to be here. Thank you.
How did this get started? I mean, you were relatively new to Iowa when you started taking these pictures, right?
Yeah. So my wife and I moved here in 2012. We'd spent 22 years in Chicago and never thought we'd leave. We had established careers there. And my wife was offered a job at the university. And so we both found ourselves all of a sudden in the middle of Iowa. And as a photographer, my first instinct was just, I need to know everything I can about this place. And I just started heading out in every direction from Iowa City and taking photos in an attempt to just kind of get a grounding and discover more about this place.
So what was it that you saw? What was that first photo that you took that kind of got you hooked?
Yeah, so I had a meeting with some wedding clients in Galena when I first got here. And on the way back, I got a flat in Dubuque. And so I pulled in to get this tire fixed, and I pull into the shop, get out of the car, and I look up, and in the middle of Dubuque, there's this car wash called Miracle Car Wash, and had this amazingly gorgeous 1940s era kind of neon sign with an arrow pointing, and it was just really amazing. I was like, wow, look at that. And I've always been drawn to these kind of older things, old motels, cars, etc. So, of course, it's right up my alley. But I never really expected when I moved to Iowa to find things like this. I had more of a vision of a rural landscape, and a lot of it is. But yeah, when I took that photo, I was kind of like, wow, look at that. And not only the sign, but it was a sign with the next to this wall, and the wall had kind of like fake brick paneling covering up the cinder block wall that looked like it was from the 70s, and it's sort of chipping off, and the paint's chipping, and there's also this mural that was painted in another time period, and I was kind of like, we have this sign from the 40s, we've got this fake brick from the 70s, we've got this mural that's chipping paint, and it's kind of like, I love these sort of layers of time that are happening in this photo, and it kind of set the template for wanting to head out and build upon this kind of idea.
Well, and you did head out. You've taken road trips all over the state. Tell me what, where you've been and how you decided where to go.
Yeah, well, after Dubuque, my wife and I wanted to see the American Gothic House in Eldon. And being excited about this Dubuque trip, I made it specifically to be about photographing. And so as we're heading to Eldon, we pass by Fairfield and start to see these references to transcendental meditation. And we're like, what is going on here? Out in the middle of nowhere, Transcendental School of Business Management or something. And so here we are heading to this iconically rural imagery of Grant Wood, this home and this farmer and his wife, and we're passing by sort of like transcendental stuff. This kind of blew us away. And we also swung through Ottumwa on that same trip, and I ran into this kind of old restaurant called Canteen Lunch. And it's kind of like in this back alley. It's from the 30s, kind of old classic.
Right. They built a parking garage over it because they wanted to maintain the canteen, which is an icon and has been there forever. But it looks a little sad now, stuck underneath the parking ramp.
Yeah, it does. But it's also kind of amazing, you know. And my first instinct was to zoom in on the Canteen Lunch and try to, you know, hide the fact that it's underneath this parking garage that's kind of modern, bland architecture and literally over the top of this building. But I realized, no, what's really amazing about this is that they've preserved this place. They kept it, and they needed to build this parking garage, but they built it on top of it, and it really tied into what I was seeing with this Miracle Car Wash in Dubuque, this kind of layers of time kind of thing. And so that's what I started looking for and seeing all over the place, these examples of these kind of older things from another time and how they exist in this current environment, in this current world.
Now, I think by looking at your pictures, you introduced them to us with no context, so other than location.
Sure.
And so you don't explain your thinking, right. Although I think after looking at your pictures, I understand you better than I did before looking at your pictures. But I want to bring up that American Gothic trip because
sure.
I think that sheds some light on your eye and what you were looking for, because a lot of us have visited the American Gothic house in Eldon and a lot of us have taken pictures there.
Sure.
And most of us are trying to recreate the painting that
right.
Grant Wood
okay, sure.
created. The picture that you include in your book from that trip is simply a picture of the street sign that says American Gothic, turn left.
Yes.
So tell me why that was the image from Eldon that you put in the book.
Yeah, you know, so when you're going to photograph something everyone else has photographed as a photographer, you want to approach it as, you know, early on in my career, I would have said, I'm going to take a photo of this thing because it's cool. Then it kind of turned into getting arty, like, I'm going to take a photo of American Gothic, but how can I make it cool? How can I make it look neat? And really, on this project, it evolved more into how can I show what I find interesting about this? And really what I found interesting is that you picture this house to be in the country. It seems like it's a farmhouse and these are farmers, but it's actually in the middle of a town. It's right in Eldon. And so there's this kind of idea that what's the bigger context for this? How does it fit in with these things? Yeah, and there's also this feeling that everyone gets when you're driving to a place and you know it's iconic and you're going to see it. And there's that sort of verge where it's like, well, we're almost there. There's the sign. It says it's right over there. I can't believe it. How can it be in this location? And so what I really wanted to do more was express that notion that, you know, thinking about the greater context of where this thing is and how it fits into more of a less of a rural and more of a town location kind of thing. And also you can kind of create a new context when you put Gary Winogrand, one of my favorite photographers, says when you put four corners around a set of facts, you change those facts. And yeah, the photo of the American Gothic sign, it's kind of like, how does it reread when you obliterate everything outside of the frame line and just make it specifically about this location? And yeah, also I'm interested in these sort of no man's land areas where people wouldn't normally take a photo. It's kind of like you're right before the place. And if you take a photo there, what can you make with it? And you're really trying to solve problems as a photographer. How can I resolve this? How can I solve this into a photo and work with what you have? And to me, personally, I feel like it really captured more of how I felt about the place than if I had taken a photo straight on of the place, which, of course, I did. It was just a very boring photo.
So in looking through your book, At first, I started flipping through quickly, and then I realized I needed to slow down because, again, you're not telling me what to see. You're not telling me what to think. So I have to do the work myself. But it's pretty clear. I didn't get every single one, but it's pretty clear that these pairings that
sure.
you created of the photos on the left page and the right page, every time you flip the page, that there's a relationship between these pictures. And it's not necessarily going to immediately be obvious what the relationship is. It may be a color that's echoed in one picture and then another, or a shape. It may be subject matter. How did you go about deciding what to include and then creating these pairings?
Yeah, so that was a really challenging and exciting part of this book when I decided to put everything together. And yeah, you're going to make comparisons whether the comparisons were intended or not. And that's something I quickly realized, is that when you put two photos on facing pages, and it's just one photo on this page and one photo on this, you're going to make connections. And it's something I started realizing. And so I went back through classic photo books that inspired me, such as Stephen Shore's Uncommon Places and Eggleston's Guide and The Americans by Robert Frank, and started kind of seeing how they resolved and solved similar issues. Because I don't remember looking through Uncommon Places, which is a book that has a photo on each opposing page, and never and took for granted that he was brilliant at pulling off a way that you never made a pairing comparison with them. He was able to selectively make photos that were so different and so engaging that you didn't make those connections. And so I tried to do that in some places, and then also where you're not thinking about the pairings, but other ones where they're blatant comparisons. And when you put all these photos together, for me personally, I started to make connections and realizing what I was thinking of on more of a subconscious level, because there's all these themes and connections that happen. But yeah, everything in the book is very intentional. The pairings are intentional, even when I'm trying to make them not look like they belong together. And I wanted to really flow and have sort of a beginning, a middle, and an end, and just sort of read as kind of like a poem with this long abstract lines that sort of connect and come together. But yeah, it does have a beginning, a middle, and an end. The pairings are very important, and thank you for catching that.
Well, there was one that I thought was really poignant, and I was not expecting to feel that way. You mentioned the canteen,
sure.
In Ottumwa. So that is paired on the left-hand side with a closed Made Right, closed and abandoned Made Right, which of course also serves loose meat sandwiches. But I grew up in small town Iowa, and Made Rights were the heart and soul of many communities, and
sure.
they're almost all closed.
Right.
So I
yeah.
found myself feeling a lot looking at those pictures and that pairing that maybe was intentional, maybe was not. But what do you want people to take away from this experience? What do you want people to feel when they look at these pictures?
Yeah, I guess I didn't know that at the time. And you know, when you make a photo of photos made from Iowa, inevitably it's going to read as a book about Iowa. But I wasn't necessarily doing that at the time. And I guess what I want people to be left with is I'm really trying to, you know, there's some spectacular stuff in here, but a lot of this stuff is sort of about finding things in common scenes and common situations and things that someone might not give an eye to, but can see that there's a lot of beauty in just these simple objects and simple things. And also there's so much amazing stuff to be found in Iowa. I guess really what I'm left with is, you know, I think there's a lot of people who never really leave their immediate community, and a lot of people who take I-80 and I-35 to get where they need to go. And I've talked to a lot of people who've seen this book who said, I've lived here my whole life and I've never been to so many of these places. And this makes me really want to go out and explore more. So yeah, I don't necessarily feel like I want a throng of tourists to be flocking to these small towns that aren't expecting them to come. But, you know, I do hope that more people head out and just really explore the state and see what it has to offer, you know, because it's really bountiful. There's just so many amazing things here. And I feel like I've really just scratched the surface. I've been to every county. I've been all over the state. And really, I want to continue this over the rest of my life just excited about what I can find.
How has this experience helped you understand Iowa? It sounds like you came here not knowing a whole lot about the state.
Yeah, when I moved to Iowa City, I felt like I was living on this cool island in the middle of a sea of green, of chlorophyll, of cornfields and soybean and stuff. And really, the book is really heavy on color. I love color. And I didn't really expect to see so many colorful things. And I didn't really intend to photograph small towns, but that's really where a lot of the magic was for me. I love how in these small towns, and there's been a lot of decline in rural communities due to shifts in agriculture and the needs of farming and as things move more large scale. And so, a lot of these places, I love how people have just really brightened things up and put fresh coats of paint on things. And I just love all these images that are so colorful and people painting murals on the walls downtown and stuff. And it's great. I guess the color, there's just color in life. And the people here are very friendly in kind of a subtle sort of way. Everyone kind of left me alone, but they'd also didn't bother me. They didn't really approach me too much, with a few exceptions. But generally, I just got this really nice vibe from going around the state and just the pleasantness of small towns and the people and the quietness of these places.
One of the things I really enjoyed about the collection, there have been people who have, they take photos with more of an agenda, and a collection that I talked with somebody about a few years ago was very much painting a dark picture of rural Iowa. And, there's a dark side,
sure,
but there's also a bright side, mm-hmm. And I found myself in looking at your pictures, stopping and looking sometimes at buildings that were pretty derelict, mm-hmm. but seeing the beauty.
Thank you.
In that.
Okay. That's what I'm trying to do. Like, yeah, I think there's a trend in photography that's now moving rural, where it started out with people going into ghettos and inner city and devastation and going to Detroit and being like, look how bad everything is and look how miserable. And you know what? We all know it. We don't have to share it. It's kind of like we don't need to tell everyone things are bad. We know it. And that kind of what used to be limited to inner city has moved more into these small towns and stuff. But yeah, I'm not really interested. It's kind of like, why take your time to write a bad record review? Why don't you just write a review for a record that's great because people want to hear about great records? Why waste your time writing about something in a negative way? And there's so much beautiful stuff to find here. So, why waste anyone's time with focusing on the negative?
Well, thanks for helping me look at things in a little bit different way, Barry.
Thank you.
Barry Phipps has been traveling the state and taking pictures for the last 6 years. We can now see his work in the new book, Between Gravity and What Cheer. He'll be at Film Scene in Iowa City Thursday, May 3rd at 5:30, signing books and then giving a lecture about what he learned as he took these photos. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.